Okay, dudes.
Yeah. All right. Is it time?
Yeah.
All right, baby.
Yeah.
Let's see. The sun is my enemy.
Well, yours too.
I always sit where there's tables.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to sit on.
Yeah, okay.
Right here, you don't have it in your face, but you will have it on
your
body.
Need-
I don't mind. I'll kind of back into the corner a little bit.
Is that better?
I want to see
you.
Oh, you want to see me? Oh, yeah. Well,
you want to be out of the sun, but
yeah,
you don't have
here.
In the back.
How about this?
Here?
That's good.
Got
aquí.
Aquí.
Oh,
no.
Nope.
No, I'm good right here.
Yeah, do that.
Sorry, the sun is like my, I feel like a vampire.
Okay,
that's good. Do I want it? I do, I want it.
Okay,
good.
Yeah,
I'm good now.
Okay.
I'm good now. Doxy.
Well, first of all, thank you for letting me participate in this. I want to thank Shinbei and the people that he has introduced me. Some of you I know by reputation. Now I see you in person. So I also want to start with something in response to Shinbei's remark about mastery. Now, certainly I don't have any mastery of economics, and I say this on purpose, not to be just self-deprecating, because I'm not formally an economist. I consider this an asset rather than a liability, but because I also think that, and that's a very strong statement, that I think economics is a very important, or the economy is a very important aspect of how we live together. And I think economics, as one way of trying to be supposedly the theory or the practice of enabling a society to deal with its economy, is a total disaster. So at the same time, I don't want to make economics more important than it is. I just want to draw attention to the fact that I consider it a very, I wouldn't even go as far to call it a form of knowledge that is pathological, because I don't want to medicalize problems that we don't understand. The complexity of the situation that we're finding ourselves is enormous. At the same time, I believe that we have arrived in this condition because for about 100 years, so-called neoclassical economics has dominated both the thinking and most perversely and subversively has infiltrated many, many practices. So in other words, you don't have to be an economist to believe the stuff that is going on all the time. As a matter of fact, I like to call a lot of economics a form of pig Latin, which is a way of speaking ordinary language by putting an extra syllable. So they're basically speaking a lot of banalities about economic life, but they mask it with mathematical modeling. Mathematical modeling being the pig Latin of economics.
Excuse me. Lines of the last several days. Forgive me, Shinbei.
That's a newspaper headline.
So that's a bit of also Shinbei has also encouraged me sometimes, but this is not the occasion, to go into ranting and raving. But I don't need to rant. I think we can outdo each other with a bit of drinks at the end. I'm speaking here to the converted, so I don't need to elaborate. However, there are very serious problems now on the, if we like, in the content of the discipline, what I think economics or the economy is about. And again, I'm making this distinction going back and forth because I like to imagine that I can develop a meta language to bring it back to the concerns of the group and to what Helga was talking about as a way of helping people who are actually are part of the economy. So in that sense, economics should be a meta language for enabling and facilitating this way of the practices that people consider to be engaged. So that means being an old Greek, I have to do, and among literate people, you can already do a diagnosis of the situation by looking at the very etymology of the word economy, which is a very interesting one. And I want to sort of give you a little bit my own potted version of it because it's not necessarily accepted. Ecos, right? Of course, ecological, but of course, it's the Greek oikos, home, blah, blah, home, the earth, or maybe the world is our home. Wheeler, wrote his autobiography, so at home in the world, And Johnny was at home in the world in his own funny way, and I'll return to that. And then comes nomi, right? Nomos, which is, of course, means law. That's the one version of nomos. The version now that, I mean, the etymology, but the more controversial one, I mean, not controversial, but the one that it has not been picked up, but I want to bring up, has to do with nemos, which is a Greek etymology for nemos means to cut, to partition. So the idea of nomos is not to be a top-down, as it were, principle that controls. Instead, is a procedure for differentiating. So nemo, the whole idea of nemo is how do we cut and make a part out of a whole. So already economy is from the get-go connected with the most fundamental process problem of philosophy, the part and the whole, the one and the many. So what is one under which, you know, certain parts can fall, and how do these parts can be connected back to the one? I mean, by what operation and what's the relationship? I mean, nemos already implies like a cake, a knife, you know, that you cut. But many other things don't necessarily differentiate by such straightforward act. So that's one issue. Now, I also want to bring this up because I believe Plato, who everybody wrote off as supposedly being out there in the academy, where no one could enter it without knowing geometry, or now I would add quantum mechanics. Should not enter it without quantum mechanics. And this is my academy. This is an important qualification. Is Plato was very much concerned, and in a lot of his books, not just the Laws, but also in the Republic, to more or less come to critique the political system of Athens. And of course, people have always criticized him, right? That he was an elitist, that he was not really understanding the true political life of Athenians, and instead, you know, he was just having these highfalutin thoughts of an ideal society. I really think he was not an idealist, at least in my reading. I really think he understood that the idea of a governing, a body of citizens, or body of people coming together to form a community was an extremely complex problem. And he was already beginning a lot of his ideas about numbers and things that were the Platonic forms and things of that sort. There were attempts, not at numerology, so to speak, or just the archetypal forms of governance, but at ways of understanding how do these forms manifest in the world. Mm-hmm. So Plato was really, already the first Deleuzian, if you read him properly, you know? I mean, reverse Platonism. You know? Reverse Platonism.
You don't hear that every day.
Not since Badu.
Okay.
Sexis que mimesis.
Correct. And this is now two interesting things, because the idea of cathexis is a very interesting notion in itself. Again, I play up the Greek. Katohi, you know, how do you grasp something? And to what extent this idea of grasping becomes something that you call property versus possession. Okay, that is a very important distinction.
Oh, good. Can I interrupt?
Yeah, you can interrupt.
One of the things that I was thinking and I forgot to say, what interests me, and that is apropos this, is so to speak like this notion of what it means to have.
Yeah.
That Gabriel Tarde is basically is talking about both in a physical and in a kind of property, the economic sense.
Yes.
Anyway, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yeah, so that's good.
Just that's mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
So now that I kind of preface this, I want to return to what is my main beef and frustration, and I have encountered it both with professional groups and with others who try to ask me, what do you try to do? And I say, what are you studying? And if I want to get pithy and really, I say, I study nothing. nothing? Yes, I study nothing. As a matter of fact, my very quick and dirty definition of money is the nothing that is. Now, we're not going to discuss this further. This is just a teaser for further implication. But the reason I bring it up is because I really think one of the biggest sins economics, and for that matter, the rest of social science has performed, is that they have left the topic of money as a concept, as an intellectual topic, as something that has not been addressed. And it has kind of fallen between the chairs. Please, yes.
I'm not an economist, but I'm not an economist.
Yes.
They struggle all the time with Excel triangles, why money emerged, a store of value, a medium of exchange. All of those issues are just standard parts of economics.
No, actually, they're standard parts of economics of jumping into saying, I mean, if you have read Samuelson or something like this, right, they tell you this thing, what are the functions of money? They tell you the perennial story of barter, that it was too uncool and complicated.
And vexel triangles.
And vexel triangles, and that's it. And then you also have now to even give it now a bit more legitimate thing. And I had conversations with him about this social choice, a la Kenneth Arrow, okay? How do you divide in a manner that, you know, that follows, you know, some kind of a logical, deductive process. However, all of economics basically makes it, and they discuss it because they take it for granted, is to say, yes, of course, we have goods that are priced, and they have a nominal price, which basically means it's something for which you exchange one good for another, because nominal means that the money has no value other than enabling this transaction, okay? So if you want to pay attention to the store of value part, the store of value, that means then you have to understand something now about the temporal nature of what money has done to destroy the traditional view of supply and demand. Mm. Because usually when we exchange in this barter-like fashion, right, everything in the event of this exchange, this transaction, is completed after that. The thing with money is that it gives you a time delay, which allows, therefore, to have a gap between supply and demand. And therefore, now you find yourself on top of that to be empowered with this thing that, because it has bought you time, this bought time is the stored value that money now embodies in this form.
Do you mean by the delay that, for example, I buy and you sell, and there's a delay between, the order executes, right? So
no, you buy and you sell for money. You buy and you sell with money. Not you buy.
Sure.
Yes.
I buy and I sell. But what's the delay? I mean, I buy 100 shares of IBM, and it goes in. It says, hang on.
Yeah, please.
Then it says the order has been filled. That means that there's been a counterparty. So I suppose that there's a moment at which that transaction has occurred electronically.
Yes.
Where is the delay between?
Money is a potential good, I think, is what
you mean.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yes. Yeah, that's what I mean, yes.
You mean what? Money is
savings,
what?
A potential good.
Money you don't spend.
Right,
fine.
Right.
Okay.
That's what I mean. Okay, yes.
Okay,
yes, right. Yes, money you don't spend, that all of a sudden becomes this other entity.
It's called savings.
It's called savings. And it calls now, to give now colors, more a Marxist thing, it also becomes capital. Now, this is the interesting and complex issue, and I really think now here's another important thing. I was joking the other day. When do you know that this transition from money to capital happens, right? I mean, is it an accumulation of what? I mean, what's the quantity that is accumulated? Mm. And you can read it as another version of a Sorites paradox. Am I right now really bald? I mean, I have 3 hairs left. I mean, you know, so... At what point are you going to call me, you know, I have a, you know, is the full head of hair, I have reasons
full
here to defend this.
Hair.
You know? But the idea is that the Sorites paradox, you know, the transition from being bald to having a full head of hair from a logical point of view is very difficult.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes, the transition from money to capital is a very difficult issue. Now, Marx understood this, but he understood it through an interesting lens, which has been distorted since. Which is the lens of labor. And the labor theory of value and has been both misunderstood, I think, but it also has put emphasis on the role of labor as the value-creating. In a way that I think, and I was telling to Helga this morning, as I said, whatever I'm going to say to the guys today, I want to bring that up, that Marx, for all his prescience, right, and he predicted and anticipated an enormous amount of things, he left out a projected subjectivity, to put it in modern lingo, of the consumer. He never imagined that the working class will, you know, instead of trying to fight their chains, I mean, he saw it in terms of a conflict that would somehow come to a head and then things would work out. Instead, you know, they were co-opted, or shall we say, the system working behind their backs, as he put it, transformed them into consumers. And now they have become, as a very interesting book that I recommend to all of you, written by a friend of mine in France, Frédéric Laudon, has said, it's called Willing Slaves of Capital. Spinoza and Marx on Desire, where basically he does a fantastic job at kind of explaining how our desires, which are mimetic among other things, are more or less driving a lot of our actions, including right now most of our economic actions. Mm. Now, the problem that most people don't understand by seeing how important money is, and I make here a comparison of between money and language, but only for the sake of this point. I mean, other people have likened money to being like a language, okay, that represents and so on and so forth. No, actually, the reason I don't want to get to use the word writing is because I want to say that in both cases, whether we're dealing with language or we're dealing with money, we're entering a world that is unlike anything else that any other living creature experiences. Dogs do not live in a world in which money matters. Magpies who like to get gold stuff, it's just magpies, you know, don't know what they're stealing is a gold coin or something like this. The point being that I really think, and again, this is a discussion I've had with Shive for a long time, I don't want to use the idea of a medium here too heavily, because to wax McLuhan-esque, you know, the complexity of money is that it tells you that medium and message are inseparable. So, and this is something that becomes as strong as when you say when human beings communicate through language, they communicate unlike any other species. That doesn't mean that other species don't communicate, or human beings in other modalities, they do not behave more like bees or and other kind of modes of communication that we share with animals and everything else. But I believe the moment language enters the stage, it transforms everything. Mutatis mutandis with money. And to make the point very dramatic, vis-a-vis language first, and then I bring it to finance, which is the thing where I want to end up very briefly. Language understood, now to make the Derridian point, and that's where I sort of thought Derrida's was interesting insight, but I want now to up the ante, is to basically say that really language, and correct me if I paraphrase it sort of wrongly, is a way of inscribing, a way of performing certain operations in the world which have a reflexive character. I mean, that is the peculiar auto-affection of writing as a form of inscription, regardless of how you do it, as long as you bring it back to knowing that you have done an inscription that now belongs into some code. So, and code right now is for me a very loose way of just trying to show the closure, the self-referentiality of this operation. The reason I think this is, I bring that up, and again, these are huge topics, because self-reference is, of course, has been a concern both in theory and in computer systems, computation, I mean, recursive functions, all kinds of logical operations of the sort that start the computational world were based on this kind of otherwise logically paradoxical self-referential and recursive functions. Now, the reason this is interesting is because I claim that a lot of these features of reflexivity and referentiality are also inherent in money, and understanding that and how it is important for understanding how it comes into existence and how we can control it in a different way than the way we do it now. And another, so this is just something to think about. The second area in which I think this self-referential loop becomes important is in the act of measurement in the context of quantum mechanics. So the reason right now, and I'm telling you backwards my sort of intellectual trajectory, my thesis, my work, and the reason Wheeler praised me and kind of also told me, young man, you're going to have a difficult life or an interesting life, is when he praised me that I was his most philosophical student and Richard Feynman was his most practical student. That was, it tells you something, right? Because Feynman was extremely theoretical as well and so on. But he was just trying to tell me, you're thinking a bit too philosophical for the discipline. Even though the discipline was already under his own auspices, if you like, was already beginning to move into the information theoretic paradigm. Mm-hmm. But now, as we all were been discussing, and I created Sinve with that, and conversations with Stu earlier, and your own writing, I mean, the whole introduction of information into the machinery of physics, especially in the foundations, has been both, in some sense, revolutionary in one way, quantum computation being at least one area that you can see the algorithmic and the whatever quantum aspects coming together. But in another way, in my opinion, this has been a disaster. And the reason it has been a disaster is because I think it has introduced under this the information component aspect, a lot of the problems of cybernetics and information processing that we're all now suffering from and lamenting it. Mm. So right now, bringing that into and making physics be having also an information foundation is for me very problematic. Unless we now do this bootstrapping and try to say in what sense self-referentiality, the role of inscription, and so on and so forth, are very specific ways of understanding information, probability, and other things that the world consists of that is not traditionally material, and it doesn't have to be immediately reduced to a classical world to find stability, and yet it has to have something analogous to the way the feedback loop has worked for quantum mechanics. Some kind of machinery, some kind of apparatus that closes upon itself and makes it a working, a functional unit. Now, an area in which this has happened, in my opinion, and that's again, it will be a long, it will take a long time, hopefully we'll have opportunities to unpack it, where this kind of movement of reflexivity in the financial, in the economic system, that manifested in finance. And the reason how finance is interesting, because for me, you can say finance is the writing of money. So just as language, that to bring it now full circle, just as language shows Derrida is really a process of inscription that cannot be reduced to intentional subjectivity and instead covers all of life. And it's interesting because part of my master's thesis was on early biosemiotics. So it was kind of interesting, you know, to see right now that thing revisited. And if I had stayed with that, I would have maybe an illustrious academic career, but I'd be bored out of my mind. Mm. But I kind of left it out because the semiotic component, this biosemiotics, have moved in that direction. So now I claim finance takes this to the next level and is basically writing on money. Now, what does that mean? And why is that important? And why classical, neoclassical economics, and most of economics, as is presently, whether you're doing agent-based modeling, whether you're doing rational choice theory, whether you're doing revealed preferences and blah, 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 whether you're doing econometrics, and all of this, they all miss out. How do you, I mean, that's the sort of, if you like, the foundational role of what I call writing and finance as a species of such. What are you bringing into the world before you can begin to account for it? That comes the moment where the idea of measurement becomes very important. And here I like to quote Shinbei. Can you imagine that? Because Shinbei and I had long conversations about foundations of physics, but for a long time, you know, he was the mathematician, you know, sort of approaching the tools or the problems of us physicists from a more abstract point of view. But one of the papers that Shinbei, I saw you wrote in this anthology that you have with Bulman, where you discuss a very nice, and you did it in your talk too, where you discuss that measurement is this process by which that generates the measure, the measurement, and the measurer. So in other words, all come together. I mean, the act of measurement, I mean, at least in this kind of heavy-duty way that I want to use it, is this one thing that brings together these three things that cannot coexist independent of each other. In other words, you cannot have a measurement without saying what is the measure and who is the measurer that proclaims this to be the measure. Now,
can I ask a nasty question?
You always do that, my dear, but it's so embarrassing.
Just apropos of these kind of things, can we not also say that, so to speak, capital comes into being and it requires the opportunity to invest,
Absolutely.
And it, at that event, that produces the money that is saved, becomes capital.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. That was not even nasty. That kind of makes the
That's
right. How dare you?
She could be worse.
She could be very bad.
Love last year.
Okay.
Very nice.
Yes. So, enough content on this. The reason I'm happy to be here, first of all, because I always enjoy Shinbei's company, and I find it, and we have it now for many years. And also, I like some of the projects now that I think Shinbei has been working, and part of the process aspect. I mean, here is the other thing that I think we have in common. I like Whitehead, and I like Badiou, who is a recent version of some, for two reasons. Okay, and because I think they bring out something that will make an interesting topic for me and a topic of discussion, I think, among humanists and scientists and other folks and social scientists and everybody else. is to understand what is how does mathematical imagination, how does mathematical creativity come to either be understood, you know, I mean, what does it mean to be creative in inventing all manner of algebras or doing all kinds of interesting things that are really more or less a handicraft. When I read, you know, handmade beer, you know, mathematicians in that sense are very much people who work with abstract structures as if they were very tangible ones. So in that sense, they're kind of carpenters of a certain kind, but I still think they have a relationship to their materials that the way a carpenter has with his planks. Right? At the same time, that aspect of things makes mathematics pure up to a point, but when the issue becomes, what kind of mathematics do I bring to bear in another field? In other words, the field now being economics. For example, you would have thought that mathematics, that the first thought that an economist would have, thinking conceptually about the nature of money, is to say that it appears as a number. You say $5. Now, these five and these dollars are very peculiar figures that you do not have a counterpart in an already existing mathematical area. They were invented in that moment as part of the apparatus of the price mechanism. Now, if you buy that, that means now you have to rethink price in terms of a different or unique conception of number. And then you can operate up again by looking at numbers in different kinds of ways, as operators, as other things that are, you know, periodic numbers. I mean, there are all kinds of other spaces in which right now number as price can be linked up with other kinds of numbers. So for me here, this is a deep philosophical question, because again, Badiou has kind of skirted the problem by saying we live under the tyranny of number. So that says everything that says is quantified, so that says that's partly what he means. At the same time, he has stayed very carefully away from philosophizing about anything economic, and especially because I think he understands how conceptually difficult the problem of money is, which is the only thing that makes economics economics. The other thing about economists is that they have wanted to go the quantitative way, the wrong quantitative way, if you like, because they really wanted to avoid politics. I mean, that has been one of the major, you know, ways in which they try to sort of say, partly as a science, let's keep out the political shit, because now we can have an area in which, now this is kind of a pseudo-dispositivistic attitude, you know? Now the data should speak for themselves. I'm not going to argue with Perry about this. We both know we have $5 here, we bet it on. But if you want to get down to business, where do you get this $5 from? Was it an investment? And now we're getting into more complicated things. Was it debt? Was it equity? Was it a risk that you bet, a wager that you put in? So all of a sudden, a very different social landscape comes from the back to take something that looked seemingly objective and manipulable as a quantitative phenomenon, and really reveals that it has an extremely intense social infrastructure. And for me, the interesting thing that I'm kind of, and you gave me the thoughts too the other day when you say, yes, I understand maybe barter is not the answer, I mean, as the origin of money, and instead, you can say, and this is not original to me, but you can say, you can start an economy in the following way. You can start it with any good, and a promise. A promise, now, is the performative speech act that someone says that I promise that I will give you this good in abundance a month from now. So we have started already an economy based on me making a promise, which is a social act that you recognize, and then you trust that I'm going to keep my promise.
But that's one of the standard features of money. It's credit.
Yes, I know.
Which is credo.
Yes.
Which is, I think, Latin.
Yeah,
I think it is. I know, but that's why I don't like it, because I because all of the yes, I think because all
that's
of
my
the
argument. I don't yeah, like I, it.
No, I don't like your. Please.
I'm joking. Even a non-economist knows store of value, medium of exchange,
yes.
And credit.
Yes. No, they understand that. Yes,
sure. That's surely widely understood.
So I have a
please now, please. Yeah.
Well, just a question of. And it's not really a highly theoretical question, it's just a question of kind of clarification. So what is the problem? I mean, what I don't see is, like, what is the problem around which all of this circulates.
Yes.
And to which
thank you.
The distinction between the substrate of money
yeah.
as this supposedly apparently kind of value neutral in terms of any kind of sort of valence side of inscription.
That's the myth, yes.
Yeah, that gets taken up into these self-referential processes.
Yes.
How is that stuff integral to kind of the central problem here? I sort of don't get a sense of like the central problem to which I could imagine just based on what you're telling me, three plausible solutions for it. I mean, not to be reductive, but...
No, sure.
So what...
Okay. Well, I think, okay... I can give you a Jewish response. Maybe I can ask you a question, but instead I will do I will give you a Greek response.
And then I'll hand you over to her.
You know the joke.
No, tell me.
No, what's the joke?
Please go ahead.
So who's asking a question?
Thank you.
You can figure out the rest
good.
Of the joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
very
can,
good.
Can,
that's good.
We can read it backwards engineer
right.
it. Yeah.
So no, to go a bit obliquely, okay.
Yeah.
For me, the problem here that I would be the larger issue that I think people will resonate.
Yeah.
So it would be, for example, the issue of sustainability, okay, and whether you can have economic growth, which seems to be the holy grail or the only thing that seems to be driving the present economy, without at the same time collapsing the planet and
right.
its resources. So here you have a situation, right, which unless you solve that conundrum. Right now, the idea of the economy growing is done at the expense of resource destruction and so on.
Right, I can believe everything you're saying about, and I'm not saying I do or don't, but just saying hypothetically, I could agree with you on everything and still
yes.
say, well, the problem with that is the ability of any social domain or system
yeah.
to calibrate the relationship between the economy and these needs is impossible
absolutely.
Under these conditions of functional differentiation, social complexity,
okay.
et cetera. So,
yeah.
mm-hmm. which has been tried, as we know, and you know, historically has been tried, and you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and there's a bad bullshit neoliberal version of saying that, but I think there are plenty of good reasons.
Yeah.
You know, and we
okay.
saw with QE2 and QE3, it seems to me, was total evidence.
Okay.
It's like we have three arrows in our quiver. We're going to fire them. Maybe they'll work.
Okay.
Maybe they won't.
No,
right?
Okay.
You see what I'm...
I know.
And sustainability, of course, would be exhibit...
No.
Would be exhibit A.
Okay.
Yeah.
But let me bring... Okay, no, I
just
understand.
Trying to get a sense of...
No,
yeah.
fair, no, listen, I appreciate
yeah.
this. No,
yeah.
no, totally.
Yeah.
Very legit. Cool. How do I say this? The issue that I think sustainability is just a dramatic example,
sure.
but the issue
yeah.
now in a more narrow, focused manner in which budgetary constraints
mm-hmm.
are possibly imposed and why is the department fighting about this and allocation of resources, I mean, this
right.
kind of fight, right? Or what happened with the financial markets collapse, then all of a sudden, as you say, quantitative easing, all of a sudden made it appear as if what the Fed was doing, was creating money out of nothing. I mean, that's how it was perceived. And then this money was not given supposedly to help the people who really suffered. Instead, it was given to support the banks and the financial institutions that were, so to speak, partly responsible, or so it was the understanding of the mess. Here's the thing. One of the things that has been missed, and in that sense, all the functional differentiation of Luhmann's and social science and so on and so forth, they are absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, as clueless as the economists themselves, is that they misunderstand the role of finance, which has been to do something that transforms, in my opinion, the whole view of what is the connection of the economy, in the deep sense, to the larger world. Most of the time, including the way you pose the question, you make a distinction between the real economy between the real and the economic, okay? Or the finance is something abstract and fictitious. The real economy is supposedly all the goods and commodities, including people's labor and work that they do, okay? That separation is almost like you're saying, I'm able to separate my body from my language.
No, I'm just talking about other social systems. I'm not talking about a concrete abstract distinction. I'm talking about the political system is just as abstract as the economic system.
No,
it's not a concrete distinction. No. It's a matter of steering and controlling and calibrating and directing the economy from some other site.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That seems to me to be the problem. So I'm interested in and that's a practical, obviously mm-hmm. practical problem, and I'm interested in what.
Yeah.
Because I find what you're saying about money super interesting, and it's like I have the wheels turning about, okay, what is the relationship between this kind of entity called money and this question, right?
For sure. Fair enough.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say here, because in a sense, allow me, okay, because I appreciate
sure,
this,
sure, sure.
Why I want to push part of this functional differentiation, even though it's important.
I mean, and that's just an example.
No, actually it's a nice example. I mean, in that sense, I like it because it's crisp.
Right.
You know a little bit, you know the work of my namesake, Niklas Luhmann.
Carrie
has been working with that. You can say a little bit about
Well, just real simple, Stu. The basic argument that I'm referring to is that what's often called modernization is a process of increasing functional differentiation into increasingly horizontal social systems that don't have a logic of center periphery, top down, but in which there's a and there are adaptive practical reasons why this distributed set of social systems has come to be, you know. And so the basic thesis is there's no Archimedean point from which any of these systems can overdetermine the autopoiesis of any of the other systems and steer them. They can affect each other, they can be structurally coupled in multiple ways, for example, the economic system, the legal system, political system, legal system. They can be structurally coupled in complicated ways and have recursive relations, but they can't fundamentally steer and overdetermine the autopoiesis of each other. And the argument is, for example, I mean, Luhmann's argument, of course, you got to remember, he was conscripted into the Nazi army, in Germany. And so part of why this is supposed to be value-neutral claim for him as a sociologist, but in fact, part of the reason it seems to me it's a good thing for him is that this ensures that you don't, for example, get an overcoding of the distinction within the education system, knowledge-ignorance, by a moral code, good-bad.
Yes, that's good.
And that differentiation, the fact that there is no overdetermination of one system by another in its code, therefore for him, even though it's value neutral, is actually a good thing. The pragmatic issue is this issue of when you get increasing, increasing functional differentiation and this kind of hyper complexity that we associate with postmodernity and so on. Which, in the moralistic name for it is fragmentation, specialization in the domains of knowledge, then you get this super complicated horizontal distribution of systems, and then the question of steering and fucking getting everybody on the same page becomes a real problem.
Yes.
Right. So that's kind of a thumbnail of, of what Luhmann's up to.
And another thing I want to add now to make it even more relevant also to the larger concerns of the group, including the role of biological metaphors versus physics ideas, and so on.
Right.
I think that's sort of an important consideration because a lot of the ideas of that Luhmann got them from from two biologists, an immunologist, and so on, Barella and Maturana. So this whole idea of autopoiesis
became. And I've done a lot of stuff with their work too, as you know.
So that was kind of but this was interesting, right? Because this is a kind of let's call it now, just not to put it down, but the biological metaphor there dominating.
It's a metabiological picture.
Is it metabolic? Yes.
Yeah.
But right now, where I want to draw, and this has evolved also right now, what is called, and again another weird play of Greek language, going back to economy and the idea of biology, the idea of bios, biopolitics. That's one version, bios, and zoe, the idea of life. So right now, these are two things, that again, my fellow Greeks were a lot more profound, but right now I think we have confused them. I mean, partly for understandable reasons, but right now there's in the latest and greatest in cultural theory, political sciences, we sort of spoke about biopolitics. And the idea being that we're living in a social system which is dominated by an economic force that is not really understood, that creates an enormous amount of misery in people's lives to the point that ultimately they're basically hanging in there for bare life, for dear life, with very little else as a substrate. I mean, something that is ultimately extremely inhumane, right? Because you imagine, I mean, no other species finds itself so vulnerable. And yet human beings right now are inflicting that kind of vulnerability on each other. And at the same time, they live in a world increasingly more and more uncertain. In other words, they were already exposed to being vulnerable. And right now, they're shooting themselves in the foot, becoming even more vulnerable. Yeah. This is an interesting way of me bringing in now the issue of indeterminacy and uncertainty, which is, I think, the fulcrum around which I want to hang two things that are seemingly too far apart, but I think conceptually they hang very close together. Uncertainty in the ontological, if you like, indeterministic physical sense, or well, and then indeterminacy and uncertainty in the financial sense. Mm-hmm. I claim they are species of the same thing. Mm. And I would like to find a way to align these two things.
Okay. That's good. That's
awesome. So, now, a couple of other things about peculiar to me. I don't like to write very much. I have hardly published many of these thoughts, even though I'm sort of finally arriving at a point where I think maybe I might not be around much longer, so I better, before I kick the bucket, it might be worth sharing with the world. I also have an aspiration that whatever, however I put it out, is going to be short. I mean, I want to do something like Piero Straffa, or a couple of other people, Alfredson Rettel, or Pierre Klosowski, or Fred Soddy, a fellow physicist who moved to economics in the 30s when he was seeing the Nazi situation, and he was extremely influential. And they all wrote each about a book of about 100 pages each, and that's it. So I want to do the same thing.
But shorter.
Thank you. I don't know how I would like to achieve what Parmenides did, to just have two lines. I think that would be an epigrammatic thing.
Is that
just
thing. Because he written only two? Or
no, it's
they
all
were not
there's
survived.
Only, it's also survived.
Yeah.
Well, actually, from what they say, and I have studied, I mean,
did
I've
you
actually,
write Pierre at four lines.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was, exactly
yeah.
It was not exactly that long.
Yeah.
It was not that long.
It was a poem, right?
So, yeah.
So, are you...
Could you please go back to the question? I mean,
please.
This is very crisp, reading it as somehow linking indeterminacy and uncertainty. Can you just recap then to bring money back in? Just to recap for us, having this very crisp...
Say
well, that. I'll be back in a second.
Okay.
Please.
Yeah.
Wait. If you pause...
I'll pause.
Okay,
fine.
But is that what helped you?
Yeah.
Are we pausing?
We're pausing
for a moment.
For a moment.
I'm gonna go get a beer. Anybody want one?
I will allow you to.
Sure.
I got one, buddy.
You want a beer?
I need one.
You have a favorite flavor?
Yeah. Anything, whatever you
would
think
you
is
like
tasty.
Beer? Are you good?
Yes, please.
Any flavor?
Any flavor.
Beer flavor.
Here's what I'll do. I'll bring them out. You pick which one you want. I'll take the
you're
six.
Thank you.
Is that a fair question?
Yes.
You bring money back.
I think it'd be good.
Yes.
Because I would also like to see the risk of the indeterminacy relation.
Okay.
The indeterminacy and the
uncertainty.
While we're paused,
let me ask you.
Yeah, please.
Now that it's
yeah.
I don't want to sound like an idiot. No, just to circle back to Plato.
Yes, please.
Because you ended the earlier segment with the idea that money's a promise.
Yes.
Right? And it reminds me of, in the Republic,
mm-hmm.
In the Simulated Lie, you know, his epistemology, really, the promise of money is the highest category of doxai,
yes,
so and what is the state of mind when you're considering idolon? Pistis.
Yes,
so faith.
Yes,
faith is the state of mind when you're dealing with an idol like money. And what do you see printed on money? Of course, in God we trust.
Yes.
Because we believe there's value.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And we have no basis for believing it.
Absolutely.
How do we substantiate it for Plato?
Yes.
You can't really cross the aphorismos from the opinion to episteme. But imagine Aristotle climbing up there. He'd say, listen, we have to get to the category of the anuya. We mathematize it somehow.
Yes.
But it's more than just math. Right, because the mathema It means more than
method. Yes.
Cheers. These guys.
It means knowledge more generally. Yeah. Right?
Thank you.
That's good.
So is what you're saying that we have to substantiate the pistis aspect of the idol of money, and maybe via a quantum mechanical sensibility.
Very good.
Which gets us.
Well, you're going to take the air out of my sails here.
No, I'm joking.
We'll bring it back to that, Shimei, because what he just said is a way. Now, I'll repeat it, once two comes through. The way the two come together, dear Shimei, is
You're going to wait, right?
I wait, yes.
Yeah, didn't you just say you wait?
Stewmaster's coming.
Or you can say it twice.
Yes, is that the idea of measurement that I want to evoke here is something that you find both in the case of physics, and I want to claim that also you find in the case of financial contracts. In other words, I want to rethink derivatives and financial contracts as cases of making measurements in the quantum theoretic sense of the term. Which means now that we have the ability to go back to an interesting point that you raised, and your nose is spot on, of how do we live in a world in which everybody thinks whatever they value is as good as, you know, as anything, and they will put you down and say, that's your bloody fucking opinion about this. You say, fine, buddy, we're going to create, since we show that value is contestable, we're going to create conditions in which you take wagers in which your respective takes on value hold water or not.
You need to bet on your value.
You bet on your value. Okay. That's what I'm suggesting.
Okay, now you have to say the thing. Stewie's just here.
Yeah.
It's
sort of like you're generalizing the idea of mathematics to the original meaning, methanoin.
Methanoin, yes, very.
Which is
this
one? A deeper philosophical analysis of the underlying structure.
Yes.
That's based on the idea of episteme rather than just doxa by itself.
Exactly. And it's also based on the base of idea of faith, now to get a bit religious. Metanoin is, as you know, we're getting religious here.
Okay, but I don't understand.
Yes.
And it's partly because I don't understand a lot of the physics maybe underneath this, but so I don't see how the uncertainty that is inherent in a financial or economic transaction is related to, much less qualitatively comparable to, the kind of precarity of the exposure of bare life, which is the kind of uncertainty that, because you were saying you want to try to bring these two.
No,
I can't remember how you phrased it, but those two are the two.
Can I give an example?
Yeah, yeah.
These are very powerful. Bare life.
Yes.
Okay? It's 50,000 years ago, okay? And you and I meet on the trail, and you caught a rabbit, and I didn't. And I say, Kerry, can I please have half your rabbit? I'll mark a stick to give to you as credit for my borrowing
rabbit
from you, and I promise to pay you back a rabbit and a quarter, or a rabbit, or two squirrels and a
a rabbit and a chipmunk, or whatever.
Guys, you're making me hungry.
In the next week.
Chipmunk.
But you're now out half your rabbit because you lent it to me.
Yeah.
You don't have it for tomorrow night's dinner. You
that's
don't
good
know when I'm going to pay you back, because it's sometime in the next week, and that's bare life. So
brilliant. That's brilliant. That's
so good. Money arises in part as credit, and that's exactly what you said, one good and one promise.
Yes.
Okay, the rabbit and the mark's pay. And it can be bare life. Okay, right now we're trading for bubble gum, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
very
nice.
And if you didn't get it, you'd be dead.
Is the value of that stick once you handed it over.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is the determinant.
Thank you, Shimei.
Well,
that's
right.
No,
we're back to the society conscription.
But I mean, because as a matter of fact, Kerry could take my stick and trade it to somebody else and said, I would like to have a rabbit from you, but Stu now owes you a rabbit and a half sometime in the next week, and that might be the same.
So I'd like to turn it back to Nicholas at this point.
I'm just trying to bring this into focus.
So the indeterminacy, as you said, the indeterminacy, as Stu's example shows out, right, is both on the goods part, the things that really sustain you, right, but it's also equally on the stick that you pass on. Because the stick right now can is subject, because it's at that point a semiotic thing, subject to interpretation. So you have to make that interpretation now, you have to ground it back to the conditions of bare life that brought out that stick. I mean, a very simple version of that existed with tally sticks. The tally sticks of old was a way in which people did not take the stick itself very seriously, other than being a record of something that they were agreeing, you know, at the end of the year to come back together in this. In
lots of people have tally sticks.
Yes, yes, and then they, and then when the Bank of England came into existence, it burned them all. As a matter of fact, it's amazing. There's a museum outside of London that the few preserved tally sticks, because they were extremely keen.
Oh, wow. That's an event of actually they burned them.
They burned them.
Of destruction,
wow,
of,
yeah,
records? That is,
yeah,
wow,
rare. That's
amazing.
Wow. We shall do the accounting.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah,
that was exactly the point.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sure.
Yeah.
And without that, then, yes, exactly.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, yeah. So sure, the power of the thing. Yeah. Anyway.
So now, I mean, I no.
That's actually poetry.
I know, dear.
But Nicholas, say
yes,
more, because
yes,
I'm expecting the U.S. is more than inscription, because it's also measurement is important.
No, 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 exactly. No, I was
measurement with respect to apparatuses.
No, okay, yes. So right now, the issue of measurement that I want to introduce, it has to happen, so to speak, is a tripartite relationship. Okay, that means somehow it has to bring in three things that most people do not bring all together: price, value, and money. Now, these are three different things. Right now, most people say price and value are the same thing, so they collapse them that way. Or they don't collapse them. They say there's value, that we're all contested or whatever is subjective
priceless
value. It's priceless. And then till we have money introduced nominally just to convert my value into a price as a normal standard.
Will you let me come in to
please,
build
please
on your case for a
please
moment?
Yes.
With Marx, there's the labor theory of value.
Thank you.
The value of the umbrella is the labor that we're going to do, not what it will exchange for.
Correct, absolutely.
Falsely,
yes,
represent,
yes,
true value.
Exactly. Absolutely,
umbrella.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, thank you, absolutely.
Use value versus exchange value.
That's
what enables the commodification of value.
No, actually,
no,
it's not the same.
Is it the same? The profit goes.
No, but that's what allows labor to be appropriated and commodified by the bourgeoisie.
Because this is an analysis, a take of Marx that I think is not quite right, and it doesn't quite make justice to his insight. So what is the insight? First of all, in our opinion, the commodity form, okay? I mean, yeah, of course you know that and that. What is interesting about the commodity form is that it brings, is kind of a coincidentia oppositorum, you know? That you have use value, as you say, and exchange value. However, this was not where the real value, so to speak, the real power of the commodity form comes in. The power of the commodity form is that you have this abstract entity that takes the form of money, which is the king of commodities, which is exactly the thing that it has no obvious use value, other than its exchange value, pun intended. And that entity now becomes the framework under which everything is underwritten.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Not so fast. The reason is, this is now what is called a real, it has been called by others, a real abstraction. The problem is that those who have understood how the commodity form alienates, they have missed out the fact, almost like with writing, that you're already alienated from language when you read it, see it in written form. So the idea of alienation is a ruse to not face the fact that you are dealing with a real abstraction, which is the only place in which real abstractions shows its efficacy is, for example, in physics. Where measurement becomes interesting is that you are dealing with an equations, Schrödinger's equation, as being a real abstraction. In other words, it's on a par with the apparatus. It is not a representational thing.
Okay,
you see,
mathematics is like this.
Yes, thank
that's
you.
Why if you look at something like, you know, like Newton's rules finding method,
right?
It's a real, now I understand what you mean.
Please, thank you.
It's like teach students, I say, a procedure like you, I prove how Newton's root finding method works. Okay, you start with an initial seed, and then you look at the derivative, differentiate, start with seed. Anyway, there's a whole proof of why Newton's method works for finding roots, and under what conditions when the derivative is more or less than one. Okay,
mm-hmm.
after that, they applied. They actually applied as a procedure.
Thank you.
To actually approximate.
Correct.
It's all abstract. It's all abstract.
That is the thing that sort of Marek talks about when he basically said, you know, he has, also Marek is a friend of ours who's a physicist.
Yeah.
And he's been giving a talk here basically to students at Stanford and their parents. And he was basically saying, you have to understand that in order to arrive, this is like the story of the camels and how, do you remember?
Yeah,
that story of the distribution of camels, that you have to assume an imaginary camel in order to divide the thing properly.
Yeah.
So the mathematical abstraction is, so to speak, the imaginary entity you have to assume in order to make sense and get back and do the real the
division
real
of
thing
the
properly.
Yes.
So it's an imaginary camel. That's what. Sorry.
Right.
So
that's why I'm a theoretical biologist.
Thank you, Stu. That's
camels.
Excellent. You're a theoretical
camel.
Imaginary camels are supplied by the
theoretical
biologist.
Right.
Charge
an arm and a leg.
Yeah. Sorry, Nicholas, did you mean to add something?
No, no. Yeah, the thing I want to add now, because I want to take on some of the concerns that Xinbei has expressed, which I share, and Xinbei is a lot more articulate about that. The role of computational media, you know, and how can part of this process approach that we all kind of espouse in some sense can change that. At the same time, I find myself in a weird state, because a lot of finance right now would not have been possible without the computational media that are already in place. So right now the question that I have is, how deep do we have to go in our ontological reconstruction of the computational medium inspired by this view of money that I'm proposing? Or can we find a middle ground where we can bring some of what I think are important social transformations by using money differently and deploying finance in a different way without having to change the digital media as dramatically as I think is needed? So what would be that's a question. I don't know.
Well, practically speaking, how would that ever happen? I mean, that's not a rhetorical question. I'm just trying to think of ways that would...
No, I can envision, I mean, for me, I can imagine a situation in which if a bit of money was come our way, I think we can write a whole set of derivatives and writing them on a platform that is very different from the platform that is right now Facebook and Google operate on.
Yeah.
But it would, okay?
Yeah, but, I mean, I get that, but I'm asking about the avenues of social and political effectivity through which, let's say we had these great ideas,
that would
be physically instantiated in such a way that would affect this revolution on the level of bare life.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Totally. I see this, as a matter of fact, as a completely embedded.
So we're back to steering, the question of steering in a different way.
How do we escape? If, so to speak, Luhmann is right, and it is a coupling, how do we escape from a structure that basically limits any influence, anything already?
In the United States, the political system is completely corrupt.
Yes.
Because of money.
Absolutely.
And because of gerrymandering and lots of other things.
And it's detached and
so
you don't reach that.
Yeah, so I tend to... I mean, I would just sort of say, well, let's say you're right.
Yeah,
I am.
You know. let's say you're right. Then what are the what are the avenues of effectivity through which? This whole thing can be instantiated, Now I'm not saying I have any bright ideas. I actually don't. I'm actually quite cynical at the moment.
And I want you not to be, because I understand your question is totally legit.
I mean, given the role, given the Supreme Court, given the role of money in the political
system. No, absolutely, and money in politics and all of that.
Right.
But you see, here right now we have the ability to change that. We have the ability to change the corruption in politics. If you really take, I mean, just see what happened in a very superficial way, but it already has done something with the introduction of Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is not a real radical introduction.
Yeah.
And nevertheless, it allowed you to say through the mechanism of blockchain or something like this, okay, that you have the capacity, you know, to create money.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
That's still a lot imaginary, okay?
Right. So if I can jump, right,
please,
now,
please, please,
what
please,
we
yes.
see is out of desperation.
Yeah, thank you. That's
many, many people.
Yes, my dear. Thank you. Exactly.
And my view is that Bitcoin, unfortunately, really is just a counting part of it.
Yeah.
Just a recording.
I totally agree with you 100%.
It's not small. It's
no.
It takes a lot of engineering to work.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So there's a huge installed platform.
That's
and an even more installed desire for this. Sort of thing.
Thank
why.
You. Thank
so
you.
There's nothing but social energy for it.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you.
We see the normal, ordinary macro social, macro national, state level attempts like Greece with Varoufakis do not work. Okay? And we also, widespread in this country, this kind of realization that there's a big bailout, so that means, you know, our government is not on our side. So there's all this huge incentive to look for something. Second thing is that even if those structures, those mechanical structures are built, what's missing that I see is that there are these financial instruments on top of that.
Ooh.
Okay. Now we could say let's be revolutionaries, make a new kind of financial instrument, which is what some of the utopians are trying to do, and they won't work because a lot of them won't work because they don't pay attention to what helps them most: community and value.
Mm-hmm.
How do those instruments get assessed for value?
Yeah.
Which is why I see I think this project is so interesting, is there's a whole mechanism behind that which Linus hasn't talked about today.
Yeah.
That's where physics comes in.
Mm-hmm.
The actual techniques of constructing apparatuses, procedures for making constructive measurements such that values can be, you know, assessed. That's a whole other part of Nicholas's work, which we don't have time for today, but I want to point to because Nicholas has done thinking about that. Finally, in terms of Aikido, here's the thing. It's not like from what I read of you, okay, I'm trying to understand, is that we're not talking about old communist forms. We're talking about derivatives.
Yes.
Which is exactly a form that's already existing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
As part of the,
yes.
the what is it, 78x, there's 78 times GDP,
mm-hmm.
Capital floating around, money floating around in virtual form.
Yes.
It's in the virtual economy. It's a treasury economy.
More than that.
It's 78 times. I just read it recently, so I still remember.
Only 78?
Well, I know.
Yeah.
I think it's under, it's
could
a, it's
be
a lower
billion.
Bound. It could be more.
No,
it's 78 times GDP.
No, I got it.
Yeah. So I don't know how many trillions of dollars it is. Okay.
Trillions.
Probably hundreds
trillions.
Of trillions.
Trillions and trillions of dollars.
My point is this.
Yes.
Those are the structure. That's where the structure
yes,
is
man,
in
that
space.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
So it remains to be seen, okay? Interesting. But I feel that if one can construct derivatives that float out there, right? Which has this other binding to these different modes of assessment, okay, that's the beginning. But it's been, you know, it's a long project. It's a big project.
Yes, absolutely.
But it has to be done very carefully, otherwise it will destroy the communities that adopt it.
I know, and absolutely.
Yeah.
This
and
is
it's
we're playing with fire here. I'd like to also make this comparison here. Because as you can see, being an arrogant Greek, you know,
yeah.
I sort of recognize
Prometheus.
What I have. Yeah, it's Prometheus. Yeah. But I also believe it's extremely dangerous. I mean, I think here, I don't mean to brag, but it's kind of like you're doing atomic energy, right? So this is, for me, this is actually, really, I've got to say this, because I really think that this equivalence between debt and equity is as powerful as the idea between energy and mass.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's
that they.
What's the difference between debt and equity?
Yeah, exactly.
They,
say more.
Meaning at the speed of light.
No, go slowly.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I've got 100 shares of IBM, and I just bought a government bond. One's debt, one's equity.
See, that's what
or
I love them, man.
Here's a company,
yeah.
And I just invested $100,000 in it for its stock, and I landed $200,000 as debt.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new company.
Yeah.
Well, I have one thing to ask.
Please do.
The whole question, you're talking about digital technologies,
yeah.
At what speed
are
these transactions being conducted?
Oh, no, exactly. What's the
deal? Yeah,
spot
on. Because,
that's the point.
Because
okay.
The server
yeah.
farms
at the speed
in
of
New
light.
Jersey
yeah.
are
yeah.
actually spending millions and millions
yes.
of dollars to move like 800 feet closer to
yeah.
the exchange.
Exactly, that's what that fucking high frequency
so,
shit
so,
is.
So, but,
well,
I mean, you raise this issue
yes.
of digital technologies
I'm
and transactions.
I'm trying to understand, why is debt equivalent to equity?
Okay. As always, you ask the hard question, and I will answer it. I'll try to answer it. What makes right now this kind of parity between these two things possible, and black souls creating, you know, the mechanism then for creating derivatives that trade this, these instruments, is the fact that in the backdrop you have the U.S. bond, okay? So the U.S. bond is the one thing that Black-Scholes does not question. In other words, everything else has risk, but the one thing that has no risk is the U.S. Treasury.
For now.
For now. Of course. I put this on purpose answer. Okay? So this is, so to speak.
So, in short, it's a riskless asset
right. That's
paying some return.
Thank you.
That's it.
Thank you, sir. That's it.
May I offer what I see as an extant example of what you're...
Please.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is
so,
done.
Okay, I'm asking you, in what sense is debt the equivalent of equity?
Yeah, yeah. So
there's a riskless asset,
yes.
And I can lend money to the government and hold this riskless asset and get 1.25% over 7 years.
Yes, but that is because
now
you're still...
I have to explain the derivatives, how that's backed.
Yeah, but that's
yes. All
volume and speed. The issue is not what's the yield. The issue is volume and speed of transaction.
Like what?
Well, you can, if you're trying to trade at high enough volume fast enough, you can take less risk and go lower yield and make more money than a slower high yield, riskier investment, right?
Yeah, so the trading houses are trying to get close
I'm just saying,
the market.
Right, so you can't extract and abstract the kind of transaction you're describing from these conditions
Okay, I take that point, but... I haven't let you answer me.
No.
Yeah. Right.
Why
yes.
is
right.
still
yeah. They wouldn't, because you're going to take a put and a call that you attach to your stock and to your debt. So you have the formula, so to speak, would be stock plus call equals debt plus put.
Hang on, say it again.
Stock plus call.
Call on the option.
Call on the option, exactly.
Call on the option.
Equals debt plus put. Put on the option. Is an option.
Same one,
yes.
Why is it equal to debt plus put?
No. You want to be able to have, you have these operations, right, of put and call.
Right.
Okay? And you attach a put and call on the debt and equity sides, because this is the way in which you create the parity. You're making...
Oh, but what's the debt side of... Hang on.
Yes.
Just, can we go slow? So
yeah, of course, of course.
Okay, so look. I have an option to buy IBM at 100.
Yeah.
Until January 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's my option.
No, that's your... That,
no. I bought an option. No, first of all, I bought a stock. Now there's an option. Okay.
That the price would go up or not.
Yeah, for example, the price
okay.
would go up.
So I know, but that's important, because now the other side is someone else, your counterparty, has a debt who is willing to bet now that the price will go down of the IBM stock.
Why does it have to be a debt? Just
another
countervailing investment.
No.
No, I think it's a... I think this takes
yeah.
a much longer answer and more building up. I don't think that is sort of too quickly to be delivered.
Yeah,
this
so
idea, the identity between debt, I think with the debt,
because
he has a paper.
Let me just sort of say this. So for your example, Joe invests in an equity with a call.
Yeah.
But Bill thinks, look, it's not going to be in the money. I'm going to bet against it. I think it's going to be under 100. And I'll bet $17 against it.
Yeah.
It's an investment. It's not a debt.
I understand your point.
No, and I don't think the debt came into that. The debt
no.
came into that was a... I think ultimately it's just a piece of paper you have to send. I don't think it's going to be communicated so that quickly.
I think
because it's a much more indirect way in which, so to speak, it's a historical development that basically led to that ultimately, so to speak, we've become a credit society where getting into debt, it acts as a cash that you can use to buy things like that.
No, Stu, you're asking, I get your point, it's very important.
Yeah,
right.
So this is, it's
I really
think
that
it takes longer.
No, but he's totally right, because one of my colleagues in Lugano defines money as a asset debt.
This is the kind of thing. So there's a couple of things.
I think it's
a double entry bookkeeping.
Yes. But
anyway, I think it's analogous to the way in which loss recently has been seen by many as equivalent to value. Case in point, Amazon. Okay. I can think of no other company. I mean, it was one of the few that survived the .com bust,
indeed,
right?
Indeed, yes.
and it's been operating at a loss forever. And no, it
is. Yeah, right, no, no, right.
No,
in no, fact,
no, we forget that, right?
And
right.
So the question is, what's the mechanism of valuation for Amazon? Why was it able to survive? And why was it able to, I mean, its stock price has been going up, up, up. PE has nothing to do with valuation.
No, no, price to earnings.
So somebody believes Bezos.
Yes.
And his spin about potential. Mm-hmm. There is potential value down the road.
Yes,
loss,
yes.
And almost, it's almost like the magnitude of lost is almost directly proportional to the potential value. And he got everyone to believe it. Now, I thought it was bullshit initially, but I was around at the beginning of Amazon, okay?
Right.
I mean, we all were.
Right.
And you remember how it started. It was a bullshit little website. They sold books.
Oh, yeah.
And no, and you know, it's like, okay, maybe I'll use them. I don't know, maybe. Eh. Even then, doing transactions online was kind of a risky thing. No one really felt comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I use it almost exclusively for every fucking thing that I buy. Mm-hmm. Because I'm lazy, I will pay an extra $2 to have it delivered. I buy everything. Parts for my dishwasher, I buy on Amazon. Stuff that has nothing to do.
Right.
Now, did Bezos have specifically in mind that Amazon would become this? I don't really think so.
No,
absolutely.
I think he had a vague notion
that
of the potential.
No way.
Unspecified,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
But it's
anything
again like in quantum mechanics, it would be the equivalent of. I'm gonna say C, okay, moderately.
Yes.
Right on the left hand side of the equation, it's a completely undefined.
Yes.
Actual state that's purely potentialized. There
like
is no
it.
There's
I
no
like
point
it.
Of reference at all.
That's cool.
Yet it has meaning. Why does it have meaning? Because of what's on the other side of the equal sign, the eigenvectors. And Bezos somehow got everyone to believe, look, all I'm giving you is big psi, right? Big psi, and you just believe that it means something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In physics, it's an actual state because it's a vector of unit length.
Yes.
We have no reason to believe it's real.
No, and
but we believed it in Amazon for some reason. Again, I don't know why it was able to do this, and none of the other companies.
This is the network effect. Basically, by the time it is so and so many 10,000s that have done it, then it gets stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
The belief gets stronger and stronger. The credibility gets higher and higher.
Right.
With everything. I mean,
Shinwei,
yeah.
You wanted to say something earlier.
That still doesn't explain the origin, but it is.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm just not sure if I'm correct.
I mean,
but try it anyway.
Well, I mean, Helga has the more active knowledge of what you have in mind, so I don't. But. Well, I mean,
come on,
okay.
Shinwei, I know you.
This is just an analogy, right?
You see, I know this man for 25 years.
No,
so
no,
I know his body
language. I don't
language.
Actually know
no,
what
he
has in mind. Helga's mind. But I just want to think about like the Einstein equivalence principle.
Yes,
right. The equivalence principle in relativity theory is a principle that the distribution of matter and energy in the universe equal to the stress energy to the tensor, to the Riemann curvature tensor. Okay?
Yes.
It's an equivalence of geometry and distribution of matter and energy.
Yeah.
And that's radical, and it can't just be stated. It has to be an argument to get to that point. Right?
Yeah.
So this question of just taking baldly this equation and
interesting.
The argument behind that is not going to be done in 5 minutes for
no, 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 absolutely not. And
if you said there's a paper behind it, then
thank
I will look at the paper.
Yeah.
I won't expect you to explain it to me in 5 minutes for
no,
a
I would not.
Just
no,
as I would not expect to have understood the equivalence principle in someone telling it to me. It's much more complicated.
Trust me.
No,
no, see, wait, thank you.
No,
absolutely. No, 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 I appreciate. I'm honored. I understand. Yes,
no, it has to be done.
It has to be done, Shinwei.
It's
not
trivial.
Especially given that the equivalence principle is wrong.
Well,
why waste all the time?
They can tweak. They can be tweaked. But
with dark matter and energy, 96% wrong.
The point is that there's an argument for that. That has to be laid out.
It's a losing argument.
See?
Loser.
No, because it's 96% off, so it sort of was a great idea while it lasted, but it's like, it doesn't work
for it.
Yes.
Like
yes.
No,
I was not making it. This is not a logical proclamation that I plan to deduct.
No, Shinwei is actually basically saying.
I understand, yes.
It has to be answered in 2 minutes
right now.
It should
down.
Be answered.
And I know.
You got
to
get off your ass and write it. I know nobody. Do you like writing? I hate it. It's the most. It's the most torturous thing.
I have a love hate relationship.
Yeah, love hate.
Professor of English.
No, but you know what I mean.
But even I have a love hate.
Okay. No, anyone who takes it seriously loves and hates it. It's like you love it and you hate it. It's masochistic. It's sadistic. You got to do it.
Yeah,
I will.
Because it's good. I mean, I'm really intrigued by it. I think it's really cool. You know? But I mean, I don't know. I didn't ask you. What do you think of the Amazon example?
Good to have 20 minutes.
Just because these were hidden.
It's 5:15 now.
They're hidden valuations. I mean, it's like there's a. It's like getting inside the Juicer product, let's say, if I was just to find the value of Amazon.
Yeah.
What are the weird relations going on there?
No, for sure.
That produces the correlations that you end up getting.
I don't know
that the sensor product
all
predicts.
In terms of a wine place nearby.
Nobody knows why
this. We could just drive to his house and hope we see him have some way.
We take some beer.
Wine and beer.
We take some beer.
No, we'll take
wine and
beer.
Wine and beer. Wine and beer.
Dickless, do you have any final closing words?
Exactly.
No, other than I'm happy that of the responses that, and I'm motivated more than ever to write this stuff. Why are you laughing, Malak?
Because I know Malak.
Because you were born yesterday, and you know, Socrates and Plato, you know, one person was writing about the other, right? And so it's writers who win the day.
Because I know it's, I know,
the
psychological impediment to actually writing.
And I'm getting
story. The winners know it's a story of the
writer.
If the winners don't write.
No, you've actually
word.
Been
that's
writing it without knowing it, because as you work it through in your head, I think
which,
that's
which also is
I know,
like
I have
part
of it.
And true,
it
happens.
So that when it actually comes to writing, I think you're going to find it comes out pretty quick.
Yeah,
persuasive. That distinction is an interesting one to talk.
As any good idea needs to be, too many people write way before.
I haven't read Lem since college,
but
I have plenty of colleagues who do read it.
I know, but. Actually, I want to say something about the group.
No, I mean, he's a god.
Yeah, so a final statement here. I want to say something.
Okay.
Oh,
I want to say something else. So I want to praise Stu, because one of the reasons I was looking forward to seeing you is because I like your last book very much.
Thank you.
And I like your book very much because you bring out the problem of measurement has been a very important issue. And that has given me courage, because as you heard me, right, I want to say measurement matters in other ways, and I want to bring it to bear into something that seems counterintuitively far away, but I think right now financial practices have indicated to me that there is more in common there than you meets the eye. That's the punch.
Yeah.
Well, just to echo that point.
Please.
About a year and a half ago, it dawned on me, you know, a judge making a finding in court is like a quantum measure. In the precise sense that there is no guilt or innocence prior to the finding.
Yes.
It comes into existence with the finding.
Absolutely,
right?
Exactly.
Right,
yes.
Right. But, but that fact is, we talked about this last night at dinner, that fact is already has a number of pre-constraints that are like the pre-constraints on the measurement and the technology used to make it and the disciplinary conventions out of which it comes, like standing. Establishing standing to even bring a case.
Correct.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
But economy.
I'm just kind of putting whipped cream
standing.
On your waffle.
Such that in that context, and that's the analog of what's the price of my house when I try to sell it? I don't know until a buyer.
What the market will bear.
Absolutely.
And whatever that is a partially defined by me.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right. Right. Because
there's incomplete knowledge to.
Absolutely.
Well, that's and that, that feeds back into something we talked about on day one, the need to differentiate innovation, growth.
Right.
And what was the third term? Innovation, growth, and in terms of what the hockey stick.
Yes.
Innovation, growth, and something else. But to parse those out.
Yeah, sure.
But
and just to make that case, I spent 5 years in Alberta, Canada. And they're the richest province in Canada because they have a lot of oil.
Mm-hmm.
They make 4 goods and services in Alberta: beef, timber, wheat, and oil.
Yeah.
And tourism is a big industry.
Well, tourism.
Yeah, okay.
Tourism
okay.
is big.
Fine.
That's their economy.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
They know they should diversify their economy.
Mm-hmm.
They have more money in their kitty than anybody else has. They never do it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, their wealth
mm-hmm.
yeah.
is not diversification.
Yes.
In a sense, they're an export, not in a sense. Alberta is an export economy.
That's right.
And it is hooked to either the U.S. or the global price for timber.
For its commodities, yes.
For its commodities,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Why do they have to put that money to diversify their economy? It drove me crazy when I was there. I must have talked to the provincial government 10 times. Mm-hmm. invest in following things just as a starter.
Right.
But as an American movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that is to say that.
And that's why they're not the Texas of Canada. Because if you've been talking to people in Texas,
yes,
they would have done
that. That's brilliant.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Done
right.
That.
Good,
you know,
right.
That's totally spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
that
that's why there's so much money
in
Texas.
Why can't the Albertan economy grow in diversity?
Yeah.
If it was readily able, if it were, in my phrase, an adjacent possible, it was sort of readily available,
That's
it would grow in diversity.
Yeah.
I mean, Ontario has.
Right.
Okay, Quebec has.
They're disobeying the laws of nature, Stu.
Oh, that's it. No, there's got to be some deep reason why Alberta doesn't diversify.
Yeah.
And it's got to be cultural.
It could be cultural.
Call it cultural, but No, it's cultural in the broad sense.
Right,
in the most
pedestrian sense.
And
sure.
I think one could go and actually do a study to find out why.
But it might not be cultural. Let me throw another possibility to try to articulate it. In order to invest in a new economy, it needs to be the complement or the substitute of something that already exists. Where the complement of a screw is a screwdriver, and the substitute of a screw is a nail. Okay.
So you're taking horizontal as well as vertical integration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And new goods arise as complements or substitutes for existing goods. So, just to give you a case in point, once there's the World Wide Web, the complement of the World Wide Web is selling on the web, and Amazon and eBay came into.
So how is that? I don't follow.
Well,
why is it a complement?
My general claim is that economic webs grow because there's a web of goods and services, there's a web of complements and substitutes among existing goods and services.
Okay.
And new goods and services arise as new complements and new substitutes for what already exists to provide market for them, to provide complementary values,
You're missing the risk part, though. I think that's
But I understand the complementarity.
What if it's the case that Alberta's got the problem that there's no ready complements or substitutes within Alberta for its four existing goods?
Yes, dear.
Yeah.
Spot on. That's it.
I mean, they might go from wheat to soybeans, except that soybeans don't grow as well in Canadian cold as wheat, as a winter wheat.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe they're just stuck and nothing can grow. There's no adjacent possible. Maybe it's not cultural. Maybe there's no adjacent possible. And to make the same one more claim. Suppose that you're in Ethiopia and you're growing coffee. What the fuck could you do besides grow and sell coffee? You can package it and sell it. Well, you can move into opioids.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
Chinese.
Think it's about the risk of the complement. Complements are unproven. So anytime you explore a complementary, base, it's theory.
Yeah.
It needs to be proven, and
because
people don't like risk
issues.
People like sticking with what they're
doing.
I mean, they
will not mind if we get there in
6 or 10 steps.
In fact, they will probably be thankful. I'm just going to go put my shoes on, and then we'll slowly make our way. We're just going to look for a place on the way over there to pull off and buy some.
But a lot of people don't care. They're just like, I stick with what I know. Look at the Soviet Union.
Something's happening so that the diversity of goods and services is exploding. It's exploding in Ontario, but not in Alberta. In Alberta,
MTs are here.
But it's still controlled from the top down. Sure it is. Democracies are a myth. They're controlled from the top, so people don't want to risk.
I think there's something deeper than that.
You do? I think it's just human nature to stick with what you know.
No, because
Ontario